You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. The Carlisle Indian Industrial School was the first of its kind in an effort to conform Native American children into the ways of white America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They were forced into military-style remedial education with an emphasis on Christianity and stripped of their languages and customs. In 2017, a delegation of Northern Arapaho tribal members traveled from Wyoming to Carlisle in Cumberland County to retrieve remains of three children who died at the Carlisle Indian School in the 1880s. That emotional journey is chronicled in a new documentary film, Home from School, The Children of Carlisle, that will be broadcast on WITF-TV Tuesday, November 23rd at 9 p.m. Joining us on today's program is Jeff O'Gara, writer, producer, and director of Home from School, The Children of Carlisle; Barbara Landis, historian and retired archives and library specialist at the Cumberland County Historical Society; Jim Gerenzer, who is a Dickinson College archivist and co-director of the Carlisle Indian School Digital Resource Center; and Jordan Dresser, associate producer of Home from School, The Children of Carlisle, and the chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Jeff O'Gara, let me start with you. How did this film come to be? What prompted you to make it?
Well, I would almost say that's a better question for Jordan, because it began in the Northern Arapaho tribe with his work and the work of Yuthna Soldier Wolf, who was at the Tribal Historic Preservation Office. There had been, really for generations, interest in and an effort to make some kind of arrangement to bring back three boys from the Northern Arapaho tribe who had died at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School and who were buried there. They wanted basically to bring them back to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming and rebury them. I heard about it, and really, I think Yuthna first talked to Jordan about it. Jordan is a producer himself, has done documentary work. We all began talking about it, and I have to say, when I first heard of it, I thought, this will make a good article. I'll write about it, because it wasn't clear to me that any action was ever going to happen. It had been so long that they had been asking and trying to repatriate these remains. But to my surprise, not long after I first began talking to Jordan and Yuthna about it, in 2017, in the summer, the Army relented. I think just from their relentless work to meet, you know, jump every hurdle, do everything that was asked of them to make the arrangements to bring the remains of these children back. So we had to kind of scramble. I thought immediately, now there's actually a story with a narrative line. There's the, you know, the visual storytelling you can do when there's a journey and something as dramatic as unearthing the remains of these children. So we knew there was a documentary there. And again, with a lot of help from the tribe and all the proper permissions that we sought from the business council, from the elders, we were able to pull a crew together and come out and go with them on this journey, which ended up taking a few years, but they were successful, and it was our story.
So let me turn to Jordan Dresser as an associate producer of Home from School, The Children of Carlisle, but chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. Mr. Dresser, this is an emotional journey that was captured on film, but I get the sense that it was a long journey even before this was put to film. Tell us about it.
Yes, the work of Yuthna Soldier Wolf and the TIPO staff took years of hard work. Repatriations is something that has been part of our tribe since the 90s in terms of different elders taking the initiative and doing it. And Yuthna comes from a long line of family members, including her father, who would write letters to Carlisle, and she just kept it up. So it was a lot of work. It was emotionally, it was a lot of work, since, you know, we're all descendants of these boys and the families that they come from. So for all of us, it was righting the wrongs of the past, but also it was learning as you went about what happened to these boys and what happened to children across the country in these boarding schools. So for us, I think it built momentum, especially towards the end, that this is just something that had to happen. And once the Army agreed, it just became something that we all knew needed to be completed. And Yuthna just led the way, and she just did it with such a humble way, but also she knew that it was going to spark a change within our community.
When you say writing letters, letters to the Army, and why wouldn't they relent in repatriating these the remains of these children up until 2017?
Well, just across the board, when it comes to Native people, you know, people have this view that we're owned in a way, you know, museums with the items that we own, that they have of us, human remains and those different things. It's that same way. So the Army viewed the cemetery as something that they owned and that they didn't want to be disturbed because it was a peaceful and it was a landmark, basically. And, you know, and in the end, it was a cemetery where kids died at a school. And that's the key thing. Like, most schools do not have a cemetery.
Well, yeah. And in fact, in the film, it says that the Army viewed the cemetery as a historic site. And I wonder whether the time of, you know, the amount of time that transpired between when the children died and today, like these children died in the 1880s. And, you know, we're looking at 2017 of just what you said, that it could be viewed as, oh, those were people that lived 140 years ago, that somehow they weren't people, but they were just historic figures. Am I right in that was how it was viewed?
I'd be comfortable saying that, yes. I think Native people were always seen as people of the past. So therefore, how could anybody relate to us today, you know? And I think that that just is the view of so many institutions. But we're living people. And if you think about it, this just comes down to a human rights issue.
Barbara Landis, you've written about the Carlisle Indian Industrial School and are considered, you're kind of like one of the go-to people when it comes to the history of the school. You know, one of the things I have to wonder about as we're talking about this today, there is so much interest in this history, and even, you know, I'm sure there will be so much interest in this film from what happened in 2017, has happened a few times since with other tribes. But why so much interest in the Carlisle Indian Industrial School?
Well, I think that there are two recent developments that have really shone a spotlight on Carlisle, because it was the first off-res federally funded boarding school for Native American children. And so there were many schools, as I say, that were modeled after Carlisle. And just this past summer, the discovery of many unmarked graves, burial sites at one of the boarding schools, residential boarding schools in Canada, at the Kamloops Nation, really made a lot of headlines and shocked people who had no awareness of these schools where children were taken to be assimilated. So that was one of the factors that drew attention to this subject. And then with the appointment of Deb Haaland as the Secretary of Interior, and her edict that the United States was really going to look carefully at this era of history and try to discover what happened during the assimilation period and discover if there are more burials that need to be uncovered. I think those two factors are really what have been the catalyst for people making discoveries about this for the first time.
You used the word, well, you didn't use assimilation, but you said assimilating. I used the word conform. Very close, very similar meanings. But what was the purpose of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School and the subsequent schools?
Jim, do you want to take that one?
No, go ahead, Barb.
Well, the purpose was to solve the so-called Indian problem through a policy era that was kind of progressive in this country. So there was the extermination period. Just let's just try to see if the United States can solve the problem by removing Indians to reservations or just annihilating them. And this next movement was the brainstorm of Richard Henry Pratt, the founder of the Indian School, whose philosophy was to take children from their surroundings and remove every connection to their traditional ways and make them into literally carbon copies of their white brothers and sisters through this boarding school experiment. And it's a very harsh time of our history and a very harsh philosophy that's associated with these very violent monikers. We know, like, kill the Indian, save the man. I'm sure many people have heard that phrase. And that was Pratt's philosophy. Christianizing was another aspect of this. And so in one of Pratt's speeches, he used the analogy of Christian baptism to describe his plan. He said, we like to take these children and hold them under until they are thoroughly soaked. And when they come out, they will be, quote, civilized. So there's that very harsh metaphor of drowning. And all of that lends itself to and supports the idea of educational genocide, which we know from the United Nations definition is the same thing as genocide.
Jim Gerenser, you're a Dickinson College archivist and co-director of the Carlisle Indian School Digital Resource Center. I'll ask you a history question as well. Did Pratt think he was doing a good thing? I mean, that quote that Barb had there of kill the Indian, save the man doesn't sound like it. But from what I've read, Pratt actually thought he was doing a good thing, didn't he?
He did. From his perspective, he thought it was the only option for Native American survival. He felt that either the army is going to kill everyone, or they're going to create conditions by forcing people onto reservations, onto lands that aren't particularly the best for agriculture, and going to prevent them from living the way they've lived for hundreds and thousands of years, not going to allow them to practice their own religions, not going to allow them to go on traditional hunts and manage the land in the way that they've managed for generations. So from his perspective, he felt it was their only option.
So Jim, we talked about Richard Henry Pratt's vision, but what was reality? How are these children treated? What were they subject to when they did come to Carlisle?
So Richard Henry Pratt being a military man, one of the things he thought was important was to run the school in a military fashion. And that became the manner in which pretty much all of the boarding schools were run. So students were drilled. They would have to march in formation. They were formed into companies so that certain students would be, named as sergeants or lieutenants, and they would be responsible for things like bed checks and doing head counts and things, making sure people stay in line and even reporting on one another. So there's that military aspect, even when there are disciplinary issues. They would hold a court-martial, and so students would be judged by their peers at a court-martial hearing. So this military idea of discipline was something that Pratt thought was particularly important, and part of it is that the impression that mainstream white America had of Native Americans is that they were lazy, that they needed to be controlled. They didn't live by the clock the way that white people do. So just everything about the school is designed to control
So, Barbara Landis, what was the age range of the children? We say children. Were there any that were adults? What was the age range of the students at Carlisle?
The age range varied. There are essentially three policy eras that we can identify. The very first children who came to Carlisle came directly from the reservations, which were fairly new. And there were populations among those children who didn't speak English at all. And then after 1890, when the United States policy insisted that children have at least 4 years of previous schooling when they arrive at these boarding schools, you started to have populations who could speak English. And they would have been a little bit older. And then after the early 1900s, it was somewhat inhumane, viewed as inhumane to separate young children from their families. And so there was kind of a policy change where children who were the next generation of students who had gone through the program or who were troublemakers at the Indian day schools or were exceptionally athletic because they were great recruits for the famous sports teams that were starting to emerge out of this program, you started to have older populations of students.
Is students the right word to use?
Well, they were identified as students as in the policy, except for the Chiricahua Apache prisoners of war. They were prisoners of war, and they were sent to Carlisle from the Fort Marion prison in St. Augustine, Florida. They were the people from Geronimo's band who had given the United States a lot of trouble, you know, in terms of not being complacent, not being willing to stay on the reservations. You know, Geronimo kept taking them away, taking them back into the mountains. And finally, he was captured and all of his band were sent to the prison at Fort Marion in St. Augustine, Florida. And then Pratt went there and gathered the children and brought them to Carlisle. So there was a real variety of populations at this school. You know, there were several Cherokee from Oklahoma who wanted to come to Carlisle and where I believe they might have paid their own tuition. I don't know. Jim might be able to correct me on that. And then there were prisoners of war who had no choice to come to the school. We know from the enrollment applications during the early 1900s that there is a clause saying that no one has forced me to sign this paper. No one has withheld rations from me in order to agree for my child to be sent off to the off-reservation boarding school.
Mm-hmm. See, that was, and I want to make that point. In fact, we just got an email from a listener asking this question. How did the Army remove the children from their parents? And I want to turn to Jordan Dresser. Jordan, many, and I don't know the exact figure, maybe it was most of the children who were sent to Carlisle were done so voluntarily, weren't they?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't be comfortable using the word voluntarily because I just think about it across the whole nation. I think you got to think about the time and the place. Native people were just transitioning onto reservation lands and also time. So it was a crucial time for Native people, also a very vulnerable time. So I think that if people probably heard this about the boarding school, their kids could go to school there, it probably sounded like to some of them a good idea. But I think for some, it just wasn't a choice. Mm.
Jeff, but in the film, it is pointed out that some of the tribes looked at what was happening at Carlisle and the other schools as a way that they thought that their children should learn the ways of the white man because that way they could negotiate, that way they could communicate, and maybe save their own heritage, save their own culture by understanding more of white culture or American culture, correct?
Well, yes. And, you know, there's no question that this was a strategy to survive. It was not, oh, we want to now become like the new dominant culture. We want to learn their language and be like them. It was more like, we want to learn the language so we can negotiate with them. We're trying to survive as a people. We're trying to keep our culture alive. And this is one way we might do it. Pratt made recruiting trips as well. I mean, there was some real coercion. It wasn't just a matter of people on reservations saying, oh, gee, this is an opportunity. Let's send our kids there. There was a lot of pushing. There was a lot of poverty and a lot of issues that they were trying to deal with all at once in this new world on the reservation. I want to add to something to what Jim said, too, because it's relevant to this, and that is, what kind of an education were they given? And this really speaks to, were they considered students or not? Their days were divided. There was academic teaching in the mornings and then really trade teaching in the afternoons, where they would learn to be really ultimately trained to be domestic servants or to be carpenters or take care of horses and things. So it was not an academic preparation for higher education or education beyond what they were going to get at the school.
And I'll also mention that Carlisle was not the first school to use that model, that idea of a split day with some remedial education in academic studies and then half the day learning a basic trade or learning farming, learning the so-called domestic arts. There had already been other boarding schools established on reservations over the years by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, so that there were about 50 boarding schools on that model before Carlisle opened. So again, Carlisle was the first federally managed off-reservation boarding schools, but a lot of the groundwork had already been laid for this idea of an industrial boarding school.
But Jim, let me get back to that question that we did get from the listener. How did the Army, and he says the Army, I'm going to say the federal government, how did these children come to Carlisle?
There are so many different ways. There are students who were prisoners of war. There are some who, there was a case of a school having burned down on a reservation. That was, I think, a Creek school, a Tallahassee mission in Oklahoma that burned down in December 1880. So in January 1881, they sent about two dozen children to Carlisle from there. There were negotiations with chiefs and elders at different tribes, and those would be conducted sometimes by a person like Pratt. There were missionaries present on different reservations who would do the negotiating. There would be Bureau of Indian Affairs agents working on the agencies and reservations to do those negotiations. So there's various means by which people are either being coerced into sending children or cases where families see it as the best option for survival. So it's very mixed, especially when you consider that there are people coming from Native tribes and communities across the entire United States. So all of their situations are very different. Whether you're an Alaska Native community in a very remote part of Alaska, or you're a community in the middle of what is today Oklahoma, where lots of Native tribes have been forced to relocate over the years.
Was there any one area of the country where most of the students came from? And maybe I should follow.
It's very mixed. Different time periods, you see certain areas sending more students, but over the course of the 39 years that Carlisle operated, they're coming from just about everywhere.
Barbara, I more accurately should have asked that question, tribes rather than geographic areas. No one tribe sent more than others?
Some of the nations did send more than others. The Six Nations, or the Mohawk and the Cayuga and the Oneida and Onondaga and Tuscarora, who are directly north of us, were much closer in proximity to Carlisle. And there was a pretty high population of Six Nations, or also known as Iroquois students. There also were large populations of what we call Sioux, the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota language groups, that are broken into much smaller groups. And they were really one of the first people that Pratt went to recruit students. The United States insisted that if he wanted to begin this school, he needed to go to those tribal headmen that the United States was having the most difficulty treating with. And so that was Pratt's mission, and he was successful by going to Spotted Tail and Red Cloud, who were the Oglala and the Brule Sioux tribal headmen. So, you know, and all these circumstances were different with different groups. There were large numbers of Pueblo kids who were sent to Carlisle. They were being recruited by a Presbyterian pastor named Sheldon Jackson, who happened to be married to the sister of the Presbyterian pastor in Carlisle, Reverend Norcross. So there are just so many different little threads and circumstances that speak to how children were recruited and who they were in their numbers.
We have a question here from Sean in Hershey. Says the campaign to eliminate an ethnic group is called genocide. Why isn't that word being used by the panelists when referring to the U.S. federal campaign to exterminate, annihilate, reduce the Native population in the U.S.? It's apparent that the Carlisle School was the prototype for the next generation of tactics for killing off a culture. Barbara, actually, you did use the word genocide. Is that what this was?
That's what the United Nations defines as genocide. This was referred to, or has been referred to, as educational genocide, which the United Nations equivalence, well, you know, that's the equivalence according to their definition. Maybe somebody else could speak to that about the policy and the political aspects of that.
Jeff, genocide?
Well, I was just going to say, we have a number of scholars in the film. I try not to use the loaded words myself, but I think it's important. Jackie Fear Siegel says at one point, it's cultural genocide. And that really does fit with what they were doing at Carlisle, this attempt to erase language, take away traditional clothing, basically not allow them any contact with their families and their communities. That's exactly what you're doing. You're eliminating, as she says, even a way of addressing and speaking about spiritual beliefs and things like that. So it's, you know, interestingly, I think we can say, and Jordan can speak to this better than I can, that it wasn't successful.
And we're going to talk.
The other thing I'll mention, Barb had mentioned earlier about there were these different phases of how to treat the so-called Indian problem. And another scholar has referred to the boarding schools often as a war by other means, which I think is another effective way of thinking about it.
Jim, while you're there, question for you from a listener wants to know, was Pratt involved with the school for its entire history?
No, Richard Henry Pratt founded the school, and he was ousted in 1904. So he was superintendent at Carlisle for the first 25 years. And then there was a series of four other superintendents between 1904 and when the school closed in 1918.
Did those other superintendents view the school any differently than Pratt?
Certainly, they were all on board with the general concept of completely removing their sense of their home cultures. The the devil is in the details, as they often say. And so some of them might exercise discipline a little bit differently. Some might emphasize the work over the academics, things of that nature. But for the most part, yes, the school's conducted in much the same way.
Mm. Jordan Dresser, let's move to 2017. And the majority of the film talks about that journey of bringing the remains of those three children back to their native lands. Obviously, this is very important for any culture. But why was it so important for the Northern Arapaho to get the remains of these three children home?
And the Northern Arapaho tribe believes strongly in repatriations, especially with human remains. We believe that bringing them home and reburying them completes their life cycles. So this was very important to us because we had three boys who died in a school that was so far away from home. So for us, it was bringing them home amongst their people and hopefully resting their spirit for good. And I think that that was very important for us. But on the larger picture is for us, it was reclaiming who we are and what was ours and bringing these things back home and opening up the door for healing for our community. And that's what this whole journey has been about.
So was the belief of the Northern Arapaho that these three boys, their spirits had not rested for 140 years?
Yes, because if you think about it, you know, they were so far away from home and under what context of different things of what happened to them exactly, you know, we didn't know. And we probably never will know certain parts. But overall, we just believe that they all died within a year of each other. So therefore, they had to be lonely and they were in a scary new place. So for us, it was just doing that. And it was just bringing them home to us where they belonged.
Where are those children buried today?
Those boys are buried today in different cemeteries across the reservation. There's a lot of families that are associated with certain cemeteries, so those boys are in the respective ones of their families.
Hmm. You know, one thing I noticed in the film is that the cemeteries where these, and maybe it was just the cemeteries overall, because it didn't show that I know or can recall the specific new grave sites of these three boys. But I noticed a lot of Christian crosses in those cemeteries. Is that because many of your tribe's men and women have converted to Christian religions? Why is that?
You know, I think it's just something that picked up and then it just stays with us, you know? And I think over time, it's especially now this new generation, especially talking about decolonizing, I think we're starting to pick up those things and be like, okay, well, why do we have a cross? Why do we have this stuff? You know, because that's a symbol of Christianity, which has been used as a tool to hurt us. I think you could connect to the creator in various different ways. Some people do choose to, you know, go to the church in that way. But, you know, I think that it's sparking a whole new idea of, like, why do we do this and why do we continue to do this?
So, Jim, let me ask you, and in fact, we have a comment here from one of our listeners, Dan. He says, isn't it one of the ironic tragedies of the Indian school that the fact that the tenets of Christianity were used as the chief pretext for the creation of the school and the way the students were treated? As I said, it kind of struck me when I saw the cemeteries in the film and the majority of the graves were marked with Christian crosses.
Yeah, so certainly in the boarding school system, Christianity is being used as a weapon. You know, we have a constitution that says people are free to practice their own religion. And yet here was an entire system that was designed to force people to practice a Christian religion. And so Christianity is wrapped up very tightly with the boarding school system. And there are often questions, and we see in the records that we've uncovered that there were mass baptisms performed of Carlisle students. There were the marriage ceremonies that were performed were Christian ceremonies. The burial services that were performed were Christian burial services. So that is a component of the boarding school system that is cannot be overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Alan in Carlisle. Alan, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi. I actually moved up to the Carlisle area in 1972, and from 1972 until just a couple days ago, I'd occasionally drive by the back of the War College, and you see those tiny little gravestones of the kids, you know, who were taken from their parents, and it's just so appalling to go by there. And I'm kind of shocked, you know, we're on the show there, they're talking about, you know, all these things, but I don't hear much emotion or outrage about this. It's just, we're discussing it from such a distance that none of the people that are here on the panel seem all that upset about what this country did.
Hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Alan. Any of you upset?
Yes, I am, you know, but at the same time, it's like, I can't be angry all the time. You know, I'm the chairman of the Northern Arapaho tribe. I'm in charge of 10,000 of my tribal members. And at the same time, I got to offer solutions to the problems that we have. And we deal with so many historical trauma that it's in our everyday lives and is why we are the way we are, why we turn to drugs and alcohol, why we turn to those different things, why we don't deal with the pain that we deal with. So for me, it's like, I do get angry and I get emotional about things, but I have to keep moving forward, and I got to lead these people to a better place. And that to me is dealing with this trauma in a good ways and us having tough conversations. And in the end, closing doors that are meant to be closed and opening up new ones where we can be our best selves, be who our ancestors wanted us to be. You think about their chiefs probably did send their boys over there thinking good things were going to happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen that way, but there's still opportunities for us to be our best selves. And to me, that's where this comes from. And, you know, when you're with the project for so long, you can see it in different various ways. And at the end of the day, I look at this project as healing. And that's all I want from our people. So for me, yeah, I am angry. And I do want to, you know, I do think that there needs to be more things coming from this. Somebody needs to be accountable for this. Hmm. Jeff, but at the same time, it's like we have to move forward for our people's sake.
Jeff O'Gara, in the film, there are many tears shed. So it's not like there wasn't anger, there wasn't emotion. You know, as I described it in the introduction, that this was an emotional journey for the Northern Arapaho that came to Carlisle in 2017 and returned the bodies to the tribal lands. I mean, it was very emotional.
Yeah, and I think when we talk in a setting like this about it, we're not showing you the underlying passion that goes into the work that Barb Landis has done for ages, digging up records that were absent, that were not seen by anyone, that people didn't know about, and then helping tribes reconnect with the people that they've lost. I mean, I can only say this from the perspective of storytellers and filmmakers like Jordan and myself, one of the things that our quest is about is getting stories told that haven't been told. And so however passionately we react to the subject that we've got, our goal is to get that story out there and have people learn it. We have to recognize that the boarding school impact was so immense. So many children were taken after the Indian Wars to these boarding schools, either on reservations or off. And it's not in most of the history books. It's just not there. So one of the things we're trying to do here is tell a story in a way that people will keep their eyes open, keep their ears open, and hear it for the first time, not be pushed away by too much immediate rhetoric. Get them into the story. Get them to really feel what this amazing delegation of Northern Arapaho did in going back and finding these children and bringing them home and telling the story of what those children must have gone through. And I can tell you, when you look at the picture of those children when they arrived at Wind River, when you look into those young faces, and you know what their fate is going to be, you're going to feel a lot.
Hmm. Let's take a phone call from Bob in Harrisburg. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm a first-time caller. I'm from Harrisburg. My great-grandmother was a pure Iroquois Indian, and she went to Carlisle. I am very upset. It's called destruction. It's not called anything other than destruction. The Trail of Tears was not a movie, although they made a movie out of the Trail of Tears. But that removal and the constant removal and the fact that someone would say that the indigenous people were lazy when they had built, they had trails. Route 66 was a trail before it became a highway. Let's be honest with everything. This country has been controlled by a group of people called Europeans who insist that they were right, who insist that they came to save. And as you noticed, that global conference is over with on warming and total destruction of the air, the water, everything has just been destroyed, and that's only because of the influence of people of European ancestry. And personally, I think Europeans need to go back and clean up where they come from, because the only thing that the Europeans took from here was money and wealth to go back and fix up their own countries where they come from. I say give the land back to the indigenous people. They know what to do with it. They already knew how to farm. They didn't need nobody to teach them how to farm.
Hey, Bob.
That's an insult. Bob, okay, I know you.
No, first of all, thank you for calling in. Obviously, it's a very emotional topic for you and very close to very close to your heart. Thank you very much for your feelings. Jordan, can you understand where Bob is coming from?
Yeah, you know, I think that America is a very, it's a place where our history is not taught. The full real history is not taught, you know, and I think it's really easy to hide these different things of the history that is dark. And Carlisle is a dark history for all of America. Hmm. But at the same time, I always believe things come in different cycles. And I see parallels with this to last year, what was going on at the south of the border with children down there, you know? So it's like a lot of these things happen and they continue to happen. And we got to get to these places where rather than hiding it, we just talk about it freely and openly. And not only with us as adults, but starting young with this kids in the school system and telling them truly what this country has been built on.
We only have about 3 minutes left. I want to thank all four of you for being with us today. Jordan Dresser, tell us about the three children. Who were the three kids who were, whose remains were taken back to the Northern Arapaho lands?
Little Plume, Horse, and Little Chief were three boys who came from very strong families, you know. Chief Black Cold, Chief Sharp Nose, and Chief Friday were all some of the last war chiefs that we have. So they come from a very rich family of traditions. And fortunately, a lot of those families are still here today. So when those boys came home, they came home back to their families. And you always can think about in hindsight of who could have they been. They probably would have followed in the tradition of their families and been great chiefs as well. But unfortunately, their lives were cut short. And looking back, I think that they're doing also a bigger service for us now, because the Northern Arapaho tribe was the very first tribe to bring back their boys. And now it's sparking across the country. And you see what's happening in Canada with residential schools. It's just a very hot topic for all of us. Hmm. And finally, it's getting the light shed on it that it needs to. And so in the end, I think these boys are doing a big thing. They're helping healing not only our communities, but also bringing justice.
Jeff, I have to remind you, we only have about 90 seconds left. One of the most heartbreaking parts of this story is that there was a mix-up in the graves. This cemetery is not the original cemetery. The cemetery was moved, and when they were digging up one of the graves, it turned out there was an adult remains in there. I mean, talk about that if you would.
Well, it's just one of those things where the persistence of the Arapaho delegation, of the people like Yufna and Jordan who made this all happen, remained in place. In other words, they did get the wrong children in one of the graves. It was a mix-up that actually could have been avoided, but we won't go into that. I think the key thing to remember here is they never gave up. Just as they never gave up before, Yufna kept going back. A year later, they were back at the site. They got the correct child with the help of some wonderful forensic archaeologists who worked with them on this and brought that child home. And all three are now buried where they should be, among their people at Wind River.
And we should mention that these were just the first three. There have been other repatriations that have happened since or are in the works right now. I want to thank our guests for being with us today. One final tweet from Beth, a listener, says, "There's so much we don't know about our history. It's been very whitewashed. Learning about this helps us avoid similar programs in our future. Assimilation is not appropriate. Diversity matters. We are all people." Jeff O'Gara, writer, producer, and director of Home from School, The Children of Carlisle. Barb Landis, historian and retired archives and library specialist at the Cumberland County Historical Society. Jim Gerenser is Dickinson College archivist and co-director of the Carlisle Indian School Digital Resource Center. And Jordan Dresser is associate producer of the film and chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. Thank all four of you for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.